Well, the cosmic fireworks NASA created by blasting a hole in a comet were something for scientists and everybody else on this planet to cheer about this 4th of July weekend. The brighter-than-expected white flash of light climaxed a daring mission. That's something to be proud of on America's birthday, said Rick Remiere, the mission's project manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. About 12 hours after the barrel-sized Deep Impact space probe smashed into a comet half the size of Manhattan, scientists showed off dramatic, sci-fi-like images. They're up there on the coasttocoastam.com website. Photos shot by the impactor probe as it awaited its collision revealed for the very first time the surface of the comet Tempel 1 as it closed in at 23,000 miles an hour. The close-ups revealed not so much the pickle-shaped comet that scientists originally thought, but one that looked much like a potato, lumpy and pocketed. But what does it all mean? Throughout tonight, we're going to have several guests on the program right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates, physicist James McCanney, Richard C. Hoagland from the Enterprise Mission, and Tom Van Flandern. They will be with us throughout the evening, in and out. And then the last hour, we will have Richard C. Hoagland with us and James McCanney as we take your phone calls. This email from Eric, who once at some point has now been reignited. He writes, "This has took a dying spark in me, and I've been reignited. I felt myself, George, shutting down, a part of me, gone. That part enjoyed science, space, biology. But I was able to truly enjoy NASA's Deep Impact project. Haven't felt this way since I was a kid, watching NOVA and being amazed at the vastness and the beauty of the universe." Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky, an astronomical journalist and lecturer, has been involved in the science of astronomy for more than 30 years. Steve, Dr. Sky, as we call him, got his start in observational astronomy when he was 6 years old and living in the New York City area. During this period, he was a frequent visitor and student at the famous Hayden Planetarium. During the early years, Dr. Sky was trained as an actor and performer. He was a regular on many television commercials and radio ads during the 1960s, but his real passion has always been the wonders of the night sky. During high school and college, Steve, Dr. Sky, was involved with producing his own radio shows on astronomy and space science, and he was a regular on CNN during the early days of the network and wrote many astronomy columns for local newspapers. I'm going to chat with Dr. Sky this half hour about his views on this incredible situation that occurred as we smashed an impactor, Deep Impact, into Comet Tempel 1. Did you ever think we could do that, Stephen?
You know, George, it's amazing. I think it's always been science fiction to me, but it just blows the lid right off the whole thing. It's amazing talking to you about this just 24 hours and some change right after the event. So it's reality. It's amazing. Wow. That's all I can say.
Well, now, these scientists say that they were a little puzzled by what they were able to see. They have thought that comets were pickle-shaped, and now they say this one looked like a lumpy potato. What do they mean by that?
Well, actually, there's kind of a distinction here that I think we need to make, that a lot of folks who take a look at those first preliminary pictures, and wow, they're just super. These objects, the comets, if you just look at it with the untrained eye, they don't look any different than asteroids. They look like just what they should be, the remnants of creation about 4.5 billion years ago. And this is absolutely the best imagery we've ever had, at least now, to date, of an object we call the comet. Because in these photographs, we don't see the coma, that hazy area, the glowing material around this particular object. So to the untrained eye, or just everybody looking, it looks just like that of an asteroid. But there are differences, and I think we're going to be seeing, George, a lot of those differences in the next few days, what material might have come off the comet, the nucleus, and just how big that cratering impact is. That's yet undetermined at this point.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the history of comets. First of all, where do they come from, Steve?
Well, we believe, astronomers believe, that in the outer regions of the solar system, say 4.5 billion years ago when our solar system was thought to have evolved and formed what we call today our planetary system.
Okay, so solar system, we're not necessarily talking about coming in from other regions of the universe now?
Well, we're actually talking about a big belt. There's a large, big cloud that we do know of, named in honor of a Danish astronomer. His name is Jan Oort. We call it the Oort cloud, that lies extremely distant away from even the planet Pluto. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of astronomical units. So these are in between the stars,
all right,
for all practical purposes. And these objects, the comets, every so often, they look like these asteroids, but they have frozen surfaces on them because of the deep cold of space. The sun's gravity, or the gravity of other stars as they're moving through the universe, will tug on these objects. And lo and behold, we get not only Tempo 1, which has a known orbit, a periodic comet, but occasionally we'll get those great comets like we all remember back in 1997 with the super comet, Comet Hale-Bopp.
Now, what creates the tail effect?
What happens is, real simple, the sun, as the object moves closer to the gravity of the sun, this surface of the comet is laden with ice. And in physics, we have a term called sublimation. This is simple. When something goes from a state like, say, its frozen state, and goes directly and bypasses liquid, it goes directly to that of the gas. So what's happening is the surface of the comet, because of the sun's heat, is sublimating that material. And because of this large solar wind that we have, the sun's pumping out this energy, these tails are characteristically pointing away from the sun because of the stream of electrons and energy in the solar system. So we see this effect once this material is boiling off the surface as a tail pointed generally in the opposite direction from its motion.
How far away was Comet Tempel from planet Earth when this all occurred?
Allegedly, almost the exact distance is around 81 million miles as the crow would fly in space. But this is interesting because this comet is not the most difficult or distant object. As I mentioned before, it's a predictable comet. It's known as officially 9P. The 9P stands for the ninth periodic comet that was ever discovered. So it's an object that's a comet that actually lies between the orbits of Mars and the orbits of Jupiter. And Jupiter has a lot, George, to do with the orbit itself, because over time, Jupiter, with its great gravity, warps that comet's orbit. And not enough that it would be in any way harm to the Earth, at least that we think of. So they picked this comet because of its nearness, the ability to get to an object in such a short time, and for other reasons that, they go on and on, but one of the most prolific is that the comet itself looks like an object that's gone around the sun for hundreds of millions of years in a predictable orbit. So it's a good target to take a look at. And lo and behold, science fiction becomes science reality.
Well, as you talked about, Stephen, Dr. Sky, the giant cloud of gas and dust that collapsed to create the solar system, Earth's solar system, about 4.5 billion years ago, and some of these comets then formed from the leftover building blocks of the solar system. Do we know how many comets are out there?
No, that's just as if we were to ask the question, how many stars are there in our Milky Way? We're having even a difficult time. The guesstimates are 200 billion stars in the Milky Way, but with comets, I would think that number is probably even higher, George, because this material, as you correctly stated, is left over from this creational ring, these material rings that gravitationally spun into planets. This large one is what's left over. And I would imagine that there's probably trillions of these objects out. And I don't think it's just endemic to our sun, our star, the sun. I think this happens throughout the universe. I think a lot of other astronomers would agree that depending on a sun-like star, or even stars that are a little hotter than us, we may see these big rings of comets. And one of the greatest theories is that obviously life here on Earth may have come from this theory called panspermia, where the cometary nuclei may have flecked off material like dandruff. The DNA of life, as we know it, from these comets, they may become starry messengers to seed life all throughout the universe.
Well, they very well may be, and it's very exciting just to see what they did today. If you could equate this, was this like hitting a needle in a haystack, or was it a little more accurate than that?
Well, I think it's something like that, what you described, but I'd look at it in terms of firearms. Let's say we're talking about a marksman trying to shoot a target, and for those of the folks out there that may not understand this, if they're using iron sights instead of using a scope, that's like a rifleman or a marksman shooting at the farthest distances, like 2,000, 3,000 yards away, and expecting to put it in the bullseye. We sure the heck did a great job on this. From 500,000 miles, we hit an area on the targeting map of about 3.5 miles, which is totally, absolutely astounding.
What are the possibilities that comets out there somewhere, Dr. Sky, could collide with planet Earth?
I think that's a probable thing. I don't think there's anything, at least that we're being told right now, of any comet that's coming right down the pike. I think the asteroids, George, as you've talked about on this show and many other fine guests that you have, the near-Earth asteroid objects, I think, are of more concern than a direct comet. But if it were a comet, good God and help us all, because obviously the size of these objects, for the most part, is fairly large. This one's maybe a 6-kilometer-in-length object. But some of these comets, like Hale-Bopp, may be upwards of 20 miles or 25 miles across. The comets would be the worst because of their super high velocity and trajectory. And that brings up a good point that all the Coast listeners, we would like to invite them to visit drsky.com for a complete update. towards not only in the multimedia sense of things we've actually produced ourselves, but the interesting point is, and a lot of people, George, are asking this question, how the heck do you find the comet in the sky? And we've, I think, done a very good job to give all the Coast listeners an opportunity, at their convenience, of course, to check in with us and kind of scan that information, because finding this object, this was the most difficult comet that we've ever looked at least from my standpoint. With sophisticated telescopes and good friends, I must report honestly always that we actually did not find the comet here in the suburbs of the Phoenix metro area, all because of light pollution and the faintness of the comet.
So if you were way out somewhere, you might have been able to spot it.
We might, and there are reports coming in all over the Internet about people who had those dark skies with telescopes twice as large as the 8-inch telescope that we used, which is a good size to find this object, and they themselves claimed that they had a difficult time or failed in the pursuit of seeing it. So if people still want to know how to find the comet, I think it's a good opportunity for those out there that have that right equipment to go outside, or excuse me, to go to drsky.com and check that website out. Because that's not only done in the video sense, we've also put together a whole way of helping people to understand how do you find many of the objects that you talk about here on Coast to Coast AM.
Stephen, what's the big difference in between asteroids and comets?
Well, the asteroids themselves are actually objects that do not have this frozen surface like we believe comets do. We believe that the asteroids are probably, and this is just very general, made from a planetary collision that occurred somewhere a long time ago, of course, for an object that was lying in between that of Mars and Jupiter. But the comets, George, are even more complex because they contain that original soup, that primordial soup. The difference, very simply, is the constitution of these comets, as I think we're going to see with Tempo 1, is greatly different material-wise than that of what asteroids are. They were the original formulative objects, that is, here in the solar system. They contain something very special, and that is, and more than likely, some sort of amino acids or life as we may know it from the earliest days, and the quest continues to search for these objects. It's just so fascinating to be able to be alive today, the understatement of the century, I think, to be able to see all these things happening right before our eyes. And I kind of characterize this as the multimedia comet because, for the most part, I think many of your listeners would agree and your guests for the rest of the morning, this is probably one of the most difficult objects to see looking in the sky, but the real fun of it was just like sitting in front of your television and watching it unfold. And hopefully in the future, by doing programs like this, we'll be able to all learn how to find these objects. Because, yes, George, one of those objects will, of course, we know it, sad to say, come straying out from space from the deep, dark recesses of the solar system and one day come toward the Earth. And we're learning a lot about how to possibly deflect comets, even from this very basic experiment of slamming in this 820-pound impactor. This will be, of course, the subject of maybe a future defense shield for the Earth someday.
Well, you know, Steve, my contention is that this was not just an experiment to try to determine the origin of life on this planet and whether whether these comets seeded us or not. I really think the purpose was, and I don't think they wanted to create panic. What's your take that they did this as a test to see if we could hit an incoming object and see how accurate we could get?
I think you're absolutely right. And my take on it is exactly that. Right down the highway, where we didn't know exactly what the chemical constitution of the comet was all about, we still never had radar imaging or photographs of the surface of this object. So, yes, exactly. I believe that in the future, this is to see exactly how we can target an object. We've done it successfully. And I think, of course, not to sound totally alarmist, but there are those rogue near-Earth asteroids that one day they may be the intended target. So we applaud the scientists, not only of NASA, but all around the world, for being able to target an object. And I think we're also going to learn some great science as this unfolds right before our eyes.
There are some that are saying, why are we spending hundreds of millions of dollars to simply smash a comet, knock some rocks off into the universe, into space? Why are we doing this? Well, I guess that perspective then, Steve, would change if we all understood that this could very well have been a test to hit or deflect anything incoming to protect and save this planet.
Absolutely, George. You're right on again. And I believe that this is a very basic test. This is like the Wilbur and Orville Wrights flying that 120 feet or so just to get off the ground. And I believe very strongly that we're going to see much more of this technology focused on not only that, but also, again, back to the science side of it, to learn about what the whole soup is out there on these comets, that frozen primordial soup, the creation of universe, the creation of life, and where it all came from. But just outstanding stuff, like 24 hours after it. My eyes are sore from looking for this comet, but you know, That's what we do, right? And we love it.
For a moment, I was going to say that you were with Galileo when he invented his telescope, but I didn't want to do that, Steve. You're not that old, huh?
Not yet, but it's just been an outstanding weekend. And, you know, George, I want to thank you very much for having me here. And, of course, as the listeners know, a regular writer and contributor to After Dark, I wrote extensively about this mission last month, June 2005, After Dark, to give everybody a heads up on this. And I appreciate your participation with some of the future events like we were talking about here and one of the Coast affiliates, KVNA and Flagstaff, to get the word out about all the wonderful things that we can see in our nighttime sky and how to work together to learn more about this most amazing subject.
I am just amazed at how they were able to spot this thing and, as you said, 83 million miles away, just, you know, get this mission going and then get in there and blow a piece of it up. And it's just, the whole thing is just incredible.
No, it's incredible indeed. And, you know, we have some interviews on our Dr. Sky website, too, that I think people would appreciate. I was privileged and honored to be able to speak with Dr. Lucy McFadden, one of the science investigators there. And people, of course, can go there at their leisure to listen and learn all about the deep science behind Deep Impact. And I'm amazed at this closing comment here. I understand that 10,000 people were camped out in Hawaii's Waikiki Beach to watch this, George. I'm not surprised, on a giant movie screen. That's incredible. And I just reminded myself that I was one of the 625,000 people, and you know who you are out there, that sent their names onto the CD-ROM that went and was obliterated on the surface of Temple One yesterday. So that was kind of a fun little thing, and lots of kids got involved in that project. So our names went to space, and, well, I guess they're now dust.
Can you imagine 50 years ago if anybody were to be told, if you went back into time and said, we're going to have this device that we're going to launch into space called Deep Impact, and we're going to blow up a part of a comet, you know, they would have looked at you 50 years ago, Steve, and hauled you off somewhere.
Absolutely. And look at it now. It's just 24 hours and some change fresh, and we're still getting the information. It's just amazing. And, you know, I'm just thankful that we're able to participate in shows like this and able to discuss these wonderful things because, like they used to say, you ain't seen nothing yet. I think there's going to be a lot more in the way of studying this. We're going to be sending a mission probe in the next year or two to the planet Pluto. We're going to be talking about also scooping up samples from comets and bringing the material back here to planet number 3, the Earth. And next year we get, hopefully, some of the Stardust mission results from Comet Vilt 2, which will be brought back to Utah, and this time, hopefully not a comedy of errors, when the material comes from space, maybe this time we'll be able to catch it and see exactly what those little tiny grains of life are inside cometary surface dust.
Well, let's hope that by blasting away parts of this comet, we haven't created a problem for us and that none of this material will come our way, huh?
I'm hoping not, and I think at 80-some-odd million miles, we're kind of safe at this point in time, but it's always fun to watch. And again, if people go to the website, you'll be able to learn how to find this comet. And again, George, difficult to see. The truth is always what sets us free. But still, for people out there who have the right equipment, you can still follow it because the comet, I'm sure, it did brighten, by the way. Visually, the comet shot up in magnitude for those lucky enough to see it.
It's kind of still sizzling a little bit out there, isn't it?
It sure is.
All right, Stephen, thanks so much, my
friend.
Thank you, George. You take care. DrSky.com. That's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, our guest will be physicist James McCanney. He is an expert on comets. We'll get his take on all of this in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's got a Master of Science degree. He's a physicist, Professor James McCanney. He spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. McCanney was a faculty member of the Physics and Mathematics Department of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and he has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics, studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and the American Geophysical Union. I flew, by the way, right over, sort of right over, Los Alamos just yesterday, Jim.
And, did you see anything going on there?
Is something strange? No, I tried to look between the clouds, but I could not. Hey, this successful attempt to blast away at a comet really must have been a thrill for you.
I was very excited, and the one thing I always say is I have the highest praise for the engineers that work in these aerospace companies that build this stuff, and that, you know, the guidance and the, you know, these are the unsung heroes, and I want to give them a little shot in the arm here to let them know that, you know, because we always hear the scientists and the people in the news, but the real guys that make it happen, their shirts, sleeves rolled up, and their, you know, pocket protector in their pocket, and those are the guys that really make a lot of this happen. So
let's talk a little bit about the data, Jim, the data that they've got now, the data that they will still get and interpret. What do you think will be some of the most significant things coming out of this mission?
Well, first of all, like you say, a lot of the data is not in yet. So, you know, it's early to make a lot of calls. I'm anxious to look at, for example, say, Chandra X-ray data to see if anything sparked some X-rays out of this event. But the main thing that I've seen so far is, as with the other comets that we visited, there is no visible ice or snow or water on the comet nucleus itself. And, of course, we see a lot of those chemicals in the tail. But what we're seeing here now, when we see these images of this asteroid moon-like surface, to provide the amount of water that we see in the tail rushing around this comet nucleus, if it were blowing away in the solar wind, as they say with the dirty snowball comet model, you would have to have the equivalent of a steam engine producing that much and venting that much water coming out of this nucleus, and we don't see that. So that's a very big indicator right there that there is no snow or ice in the nucleus. Also, there was no immediate data from the spectrometer, the infrared spectrometer, suggesting that the explosion created water or ice in that explosion. There was a lot of dust, of course.
As you had thought, I believe, right?
Exactly. And it's difficult for people schooled in the traditional theories to make this leap to understand that the water is not coming out of the nucleus and how this works. And I've got an entire paper just on small comets because it's very complicated how they can draw in material, and then this also then leaves and gives the illusion of material coming from a nucleus. But when you look right at the nucleus, nose to nose, like we are right here, there is no water or ice or snow on the nucleus.
Now, Jim, for people all around this planet who are trying to make a living, they're working, you know, they're doing whatever they can. You talk about comet tails, some of these people busting their tails to just get by now every once in a while. What's the significance of all of this for me, for them?
Well, like you were talking about earlier, we really have to understand these because we know in the past that Earth has been devastated by objects like these, whether they crashed into the Earth or, as I have talked about, where larger objects have come by, you have action at a distance, gravitational waves or electrical effects, and that the whether you whichever you know catastrophe you look at, these things can affect Earth in a very bad way, and we have to learn about these. My own personal opinion, and of course, I'm somewhat critical of NASA at times, but I think that they should have a lot more money, a lot more funding, and a lot more activity like this, because this is the bottom line. If we don't learn how to control our environment in space, that's the big one.
Well, this was a Manhattan-sized comet.
Right.
If this thing happened to have been coming right for the planet, do we have anything available right now that could have obliterated this thing?
No,
and I'm not talking
really
about take a little chunk away. I mean just smash it to smithereens if it was coming right at the planet.
Well, the problem is with any explosion, you have to get the explosive down inside to affect it, to break it into pieces. And then if you do that, you have the extra problem of having many pieces. So there's a lot of people that believe we should not be blowing these things apart, but we should be moving them into other orbits.
Like deflecting them somehow.
Somehow. And there again, if my theory for comets is correct, we can actually go out and extend the electrical discharge with a cable, basically like a carbon cable coming out the back end, a tether, so to speak, increasing the discharge and actually, with the comet tail drag, maneuver these comets with a very simple mechanism like that deflect them into other orbits. And, of course, the key to all of this is knowing which one is the problem asteroid or comet long in advance so that we can do this slight maneuver, because a slight tug or push now has a great effect in a year or two.
Now, explain how this would work. I mean, how do you get this? You zoom this huge carbon fiber out there to try to attach itself to a comet? What do you do?
Yeah, and you let it out, and we've already done projects like this with the shuttle, for example, and we had a great electrical discharge come down that tether almost dismantled one of the shuttles. But what happens is then you extend the electrical discharge, create a larger comet tail. The comet tail material drags on the nucleus and therefore slows it down or changes its orbit. And so if you could do this a couple years in advance of when this thing should hit Earth, then you could change its orbit enough so it would miss, and hopefully it would not come back for a long time.
What's the difference here in terms of significance with a comet that could be a dirty snowball, with a comet that could be all rock, with a comet that could be all, you know, some kind of iron, for example? What's really the significance here, Jim?
Well, if one of them comes in and hits us directly, it would make little difference at that point. But the idea is to find out how to maneuver these, and, of course, that's what this was all about, as you were talking about earlier, just the fact that engineers can design and guide a probe that accurately and then get those last-minute mid-course corrections so that this hits exactly where they want it. That's huge. That is very important, because previously they just flew by. But now to actually extend another probe and watch it with the first one, something I've been saying all along is that a lot of the NASA design programs have been, I wouldn't say improperly designed, I would do it very differently, but we have to have multiple spacecraft out there watching each other to observe electrical effects. Or one of the things I was looking for here, and I have a picture right in front of me, as the probe left the mother spacecraft and was flying away, they took some pictures of it. And one thing I thought is that probe itself could discharge the local capacitor and form a small tail. And the picture isn't clear enough that I have to show if that's what's really going on, but it does appear that the probe itself was discharging the local capacitor and forming a little tail, a little plasma tail around it. But bottom line is, all of this experimentation is essentially essential to our survival on this planet in the future. And I wish we had a lot more of this 30 years ago.
Well, unfortunately, I guess we didn't have the technology to do this, did we?
Well, it's hard to say because look at the Voyager spacecraft. They were very accurate in getting out to the outer planets, for example, in getting by a very precise location. So we probably did, but didn't know it, I would put it that way. But this is a huge first step, and I suspect we're going to see a lot more of this type of accurate pinpoint maneuvering in the future.
Jim, this particular mission, do you think it really was geared primarily to try to figure out how life started, at least on this planet? Or do you think the mission primarily was to see if they could land, deflect, hit an incoming object? Stevens, Cates, Dr. Sky, before you came on, agrees with me that possibly the mission was to see if we could hit an object.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a whole list. I have a list next to me here of all of the space probes coming up, the Japanese, the Europeans, all are trying to pursue this, where they actually land or contact an object. We've flown by asteroids and moons and orbited moons and or asteroids. But now that the next goal is to contact, drill into. And early on, it was realized that these objects don't have enough gravity to put a drilling device down and have it stay. So somehow you have to drill in and hold it. And since you don't know what the surface composition is like, that's a very difficult thing to design unless you can put a big rope around it, you know.
Now, this is a Manhattan-sized comet. To me, that sounds pretty big. How would you categorize this in terms of size with things that we know might be out there?
Well, there's a size distribution, and it's something that astronomers know about, that there, if you take dust grains, there's, you know, uncountable number of dust grains. As you get up to something this size, there might be, in the solar system, 20,000 of them. That's just off the top of my head. It's not a real number out of a book. But as you get up to moon-sized objects, there's only 40 of them. And as you get up to planet-sized objects, there's only 9. And as you get up to the sun size of objects, there's only 1 in our solar system. So it gives you a size distribution. And as you get to smaller and smaller objects, there's more and more of them.
Jim, there are some people out there on the Internet who say that Jim McCanney claims that all comets become planets. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Oh, yeah, thank you, because that's one of the great misnomers of my work. And what I talk about is plasma physics. Any object, in fact, like this probe itself, as I was saying, could discharge the local capacitor and act like a comet. And certainly that's not going to become a planet. So any object can discharge a local plasma capacitor, and you get the comet effect with the electron beam coming from the negative side, the primary charge carrier, and then the influx to the charged nucleus, the negatively charged nucleus, of the positively charged material. So becoming a planet is a very rare and unique situation where an object that's very large is captured into the solar system, into the plane of the planets, in a prograde direction, and then works its way into the solar system to become a planet without colliding with something else. It's a very complicated, I have chapters in my early papers on the statistics of solar system formation, where I do talk about the size of objects, the size distribution. So not every comet becomes a planet by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's a very rare event. But when the big comets come in, they are gathering this material, and they change their orbits very rapidly because they have enough gravitational attraction to hold this material. We don't see these big comets very often. There's historical records of people seeing them. Hale-Bopp was a pretty small comet compared to the big comets of history. So once again, the size distribution, we have not seen the big comets in the solar system, and that's why astronomers claim they don't exist. But in historical records, and you look at the effects of these objects which have come by Earth on occasion, you see the geological record very clearly that these objects have come through the solar system. You see the markings on other planets and moons.
What would Velikovsky have said about this most recent mission?
Well, of course, he claimed that there was electrical activity in the solar system. And, you know, in his day, much of this was unknown. In fact, when Velikovsky was around, they didn't even know that there were that there was a nucleus with the comet. There were theories that maybe they were just loosely composite groupings of dust and sand. For example, they didn't even see the first cometary nucleus until, I can't remember the year, but probably after Velikovsky was around, where they actually confirmed and actually saw a comet nucleus. But he would have probably been looking for electrical effects, that type of thing.
Okay, so what if they find out that there seems to be a lot of evidence for electrical discharges confirming plasma discharges from comets? What does that mean?
Well, for example, the unexplained flash. Now, with all of our knowledge of the copper disk and the probe and, you know, all the advanced studies that were done, still there was a surprise that as this probe approached, that there was a gigantic flash. And I would like to see, for example, like I mentioned earlier, the Chandra or the Newton X-ray telescope to see if there was any evidence of X-ray activity, something that I'm very close to. I just got back a short while ago from the American Geophysical Union meeting in New Orleans, where I gave a presentation on X-rays in the solar system. and specifically with comets. So this is something I'm very near and dear to. That was something I predicted in my earliest papers when nobody was even dreaming that comets could have X-rays.
What do you think some of the biggest pieces might be in terms of size from this impact out there floating around now?
Oh, I think it's dust or powder at best. I don't think many large chunks came out of this.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And, of course, once before I was on your show and the last caller asked, oh, could this, you know, something fly free and damage Earth? And it's just very far away. The majority of this debris, you could already see it dissipating in the solar wind as it came out and started to move away. So, yeah, this is not something that would be detrimental to Earth.
I guess what made this so successful, I guess, to those of us here back on planet Earth was that because of the video, because the ability to see this just made it just seem so lifelike, didn't it?
Oh, that is amazing. And when I watched the I watched it over and over again looking for various conditions. And, of course, like everybody, was amazed at the flash that occurred there.
It was very bright.
Oh, very bright. And then it moved out, and you could see the shadow up along the nucleus as the material moved out and into the sunlight and shadowed that region of the nucleus. So it'll be interesting to see as the spacecraft, the mother spacecraft, releases its data, what it actually saw.
Well, this mission was launched on January 12th. The spacecraft traveled 268 million miles to get to the comet, get it in its sights, and just was a dramatic success. And as we've both talked about, Jim, the data will continue to come forward. And I think they're going to find some pretty startling things, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The one thing I wish in the future is that, and I'd always, of course, every scientist wishes this, but I wish that I could have a little more input into the design of these spacecraft because, for example, to test the plasma conditions, to measure the electron beam from the side that they're not expecting it, those type of things, that we see these things in the data by mistake a lot of times.
They didn't even ask you this time?
No, although I do know some of these scientists that are on these teams, but no, I'm not on the list of inquiry there.
At least not yet. You're going to be back in an hour to take phone calls with Richard C. Hoagland, okay?
Yes.
James McCanny. He'll be back in a moment. Richard C. Hoagland, the founder and principal investigator of the Enterprise Mission, a public policy and research group that has been investigating the scientific possibility of intelligently designed extraterrestrial artifacts across the solar system for years now. Richard has previously served as museum curator of astronomy and space sciences, a science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, head of special projects at New York's Hayden Planetarium, and NASA consultant to the Goddard Space Flight Center. In addition, Richard is the author of Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, and winner of the Engstrom Medal for Excellence in Science. And now, Richard, you have become a blogger, I guess, huh?
Yes, I've joined the 21st century, which is a really cool way these days, apparently, to put out things that more formal web posts don't allow you to. So this is an experiment. We've looked into a way where we can do this, you know, me just sitting here at a computer. I don't have to involve web people, web experts, geeks, experts, Microsoft. Any of the extraordinary chain of stuff that's required to do stuff on the web, I can just sit here and tap a few keys and actually even put images and links and all the usual stuff that I do. So I'm going to start a series of very controversial things. We already put the first one up there, which was my kind of forecast of the strange stuff going on around the Spielberg Cruise movie War of the Worlds, which I presume we can get into later tonight.
Yeah, we will. As a matter of fact, I peruse the enterprisemission.com website quite a bit, as you know, and I got a kick out of your very first blog today. And,
it just seemed very appropriate, given that last week this big thing debuted, and Robin and I went and saw it a couple days ago, and frankly, it deserves a program all by itself. There is so much that is going on in that film that the reviewers, and I've been reading the Rotten Tomatoes reviews, for those people who don't have a clue as to what I'm talking about, there's a website called Rotten Tomatoes, very cute, which collects reviews from all over the world, all the professional papers, websites, television networks, from the New York Times, the Daily Post, to Tom Shales, and you can go and read hour after hour after hour reviews of any major movie in the world.
Well, I've got a special effects expert who was on that movie in a week or two coming on, and then I might have Tom Cruise on.
What a cool idea, because Cruise is part of the story.
Sure is.
You know, Cruise had a very close association with Stanley Kubrick, very close. And when Stanley died, his heir apparent became Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven Spielberg, I found out 2 days ago as I was researching this blog, was heavily involved in something that I wrote extensively about with Mike Barra, the ceremony surrounding the Millennium Party on the Mall in Washington, D.C., as part of our series we call The End of Days.
Right.
Anyway, the blog format gives me a chance to sound off even more than I have before.
Well, it's good. It gives it. It really does give the Enterprise Mission website some personality, much more than it had, and it was good.
And it's going out all over the regular blog channels. People are picking it up and copying and talking about it and all that. And I'm going to add a commentary section so people can get back to us. But that was one little thing I needed a web person to do, and that person went off. You know, I don't know how he could have done this, but he went off to celebrate July 4th with his family. So,
well, how about
I know how goes. Anyway, I'm working on one on Deep Impact, which will incorporate not only some of the things we're talking about tonight, but in the future ones, because it's more than just one, we will have some surprises.
You always have surprises, Richard. Always. Anyway, why don't you introduce your buddy Tom Van Flandt?
Well, that was the perfect segue, because I was going to say, one of our surprises is my dear friend and buddy, Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who was the former head of the Celestial Mechanics Division at the U.S. Naval Observatory. He was one of them. He worked for the government on all kinds of cool stuff having to do with how things move out there in the solar system. And Tom and I met, what was it, Tom, like 30 years ago?
Yes, just about that.
At the DPS meeting in Pittsburgh. The DPS is the Division of Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society, and they have these annual meetings, you know, science meetings where people give papers and other people come and listen to people give papers. And Tom was giving a paper on this absolutely extraordinary and completely off-the-wall idea that there used to be a major planet in the solar system that blew up. And I was stunned to hear, Tom, and I hope you were listening, that in the first hour or first half hour, Dr. Sky referred to the asteroids as the remnants of an exploded planet.
He sure did.
And I thought, isn't that cool? It's become de rigueur that Tom's far-out idea has reemerged now as part of the popular wisdom, so that even someone as plugged in as Dr. Sky is not quite up on the fact that the mainstream guys, the NASA guys, vehemently keep telling Tom, you're nuts. You're all wet. You're nice, but you're all wet. Go away, go away, go away. So I wanted Tom to be part of our party tonight because, and here's the bottom line what we're going to talk about over the next 2 hours. I believe, and I think Tom will agree, that to date, in the preceding 24 hours, this incredible new data from the Deep Impact mission is tilting the scales far more in favor of Tom's idea than in favor of the mainstream idea for the origins of comets and asteroids, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, we're going to have to prove that to me a little bit later
on. We have the ways to prove that, yes. So,
hey,
Tom, with that, why don't you take it away?
Tom, when you first met Richard many years ago, what did you think of the guy?
Well, in the initial introductions, we were both paying attention to other matters that were being brought up by speakers, but we didn't really get to know one another well until I think it was the early 90s when we met in an online format and began exchanging messages. But I think we were both present at the famous DePietro and Molinar presentation at I think it was in Maryland in around 1980.
No, I missed that. If you were there, I'm sorry, I didn't get in on that fun until a bit later.
Okay.
Well, then somebody was posing as you, Richard.
That was the occasion when the when two astronomers first announced that there was a face-like image on Mars and express some the daring idea that it should be investigated over the possibility that it could be something other than a natural geological formation.
Well, Tom and Richard, this particular mission here, as dramatic as it was, in data that, of course, Richard, we haven't really looked at or analyzed. And as
we don't have it yet.
Well, no. But
they're being very chary. I was sitting and watching every, you know, moment of the press conferences, and frankly, they've said nothing.
No, now, hold on. What are you saying here?
They have said nothing. Tom?
That seems to be true. They're putting off all the results they promised now with an estimate it'll take at least a week to get that information.
But are you saying that there's something strange afoot here?
I think it's strange in that the model that they're looking to confirm, I mean, these are smart guys, okay?
Of course.
They know, looking at this data, and they've obviously got the computer screens and the computer overlays, and they can do amazing things with the push of a few buttons. Even in 24 hours, they already know that the data is not supporting the standard model, and they've been extremely careful not to put their foot in it, as my grandmother used to say.
All right, if you're correct here, and McCanny will probably back you up next hour, but if you're correct here that the data doesn't support the standard model, what the heck does that mean?
Thomas?
Well, there are several competitors to the standard model. In reality, even though NASA...
And what is the standard model, Tom?
That would be the so-called dirty snowball model,
right,
put forward by Fred Whipple in 1950. And the his idea was that a comet is essentially a collection of primarily water ice and mixed in with some dirtier stuff. Recent times, the darker and dirtier stuff has become so prominent that that the dirty snowball is often referred to now as the snowy dirt ball. But the basic idea remains that water ice is the primary ingredient, and we heard in the press conference from the Deep Impact team today that they are still looking for evidence that once the probe penetrated the comet below the dust layer that's laying around on top, that it probably got into a layer of ice, pure ice. So that's what they're expecting in their model.
Okay. To me, when I just saw some of the pictures, it looked like it was just a small moon or something like that. It did not resemble what they had been telling all of us over the years what a comet was.
Well, none of these objects have resembled the classic model, which was, you know, Whipple's dirty snowball, because a dirty snowball you expect to be kind of white with, you know, dark stuff and
yeah,
maybe some rocks and whatever. And when we got our first close-ups, and I think, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, it was the Halley close-ups from Giotto, we found that these things are black as pitch. You know, instead of being bright white snow, they're as dark as asphalt parking lots. And that is a first huge problem for the mainstream model, because where is all this dark gunk come from that apparently coats them so that you only would get, you know, water jetting out of a place here and a place there across the surface? And the second problem with the standard model is that when you penetrate them, when you plunge, you know, something the size of a washing machine into this thing at 6 miles per second, 23,000 miles an hour, you should get down to where there is a lot of water, and it should jet out, and you should see it in your spectra, and you should be able to sit in front of the world at these press conferences, like Thomas Ahern did this afternoon, and say, oh, my God, we got a gusher here, folks. We got more water we knew what to do with. And you'll notice he didn't mention a word. Some reporter asked him, well, what did you see in the spectra? And all he said was, well, a lot of things we can't identify.
At this time. Well, if it doesn't match the standard model, if these comets aren't what they think they were, is it just this particular comet, or do you think it's all of them?
Tom?
I think clearly all of them. The whole idea that comets are not dirty snowballs, but rather are the same basic thing as asteroids, originated over 200 years ago.
You mean the idea did?
Yes, the idea did. When we first discovered asteroids, they're orbiting the sun in planet-like orbits, and there are now tens of thousands known. When we first discovered those, the two ideas were put forward, one that they are a planet that never quite formed, that's the leftover material from the origin of the solar system, and the other idea was that they did form into a planet that subsequently broke up or exploded, making all these fragments. The latter idea predicts that you're going to have asteroids that stayed near the sun, and you're also going to have ejecta that was sent out to great distances that rains back, and that's exactly what the comets do. So the basic idea behind the theory is that comets and asteroids are identical initially, with the sole difference that's because comets have spent most of their lifetimes very far from the sun, they can preserve some of the volatiles or light elements much better than the asteroids, which tend to get pretty well baked out being close to the sun for millions of years.
What does this do then, Tom, to the theory of seeding planet Earth and who knows how many other possibilities?
Well, it puts an interesting wrinkle on it. It's still possible that comets and asteroids have seeded Earth, but we'd be talking about that would be because they were once part of an integral planet rather than because they're leftover primordial material.
And it also kills the theory that comets bombarded planet Earth, filling up the what are now the oceans, right?
Yes, that's much less likely. As the comets we're seeing today are clearly much younger than that. However, it's in the nature of the orbits of comets that they go out to such great distances, they get wiped out every few, at least hundreds of millions of years, and actually galactic tidal forces are enough to remove comets from the visible region in under 10 million years. So if there were earlier explosions, there could have been earlier periods when there were comets, but the ones we're seeing today are all from a relatively recent breakup event, something a few millions of years ago at most, and we've dated that to 3.2 million years ago.
See, there's another fallacy in the NASA thinking, and I'm going to use NASA as the kind of shorthand for the mainstream science model, and that is that when you look at the comets we see today, and if we get rid of their primordial origins,
right,
then we're missing all that stuff that you just talked about, the source of the organics on the Earth to form eventually life, DNA, amino acids, things like that, and the source of the water in the oceans. In fact, when you look at the outer solar system, you know, we've got huge planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, which we know are formed of very light and volatile elements, hydrogen, helium, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, stuff like that, and there must have been trillions of Berge bits floating around at that distance, which those planets then diverted into intersecting orbits with the inner solar system. And so the comets may be a metaphor for a process that did go on billions of years ago, but the guys we're seeing now are only the distant, distant evolved cousins of those ancient, really primordial relics that NASA thinks they're looking at.
Okay, so if they changed, why did they change? You would think they would have stayed the same.
Well, no, because they would be scoured out. They would either be sent into the sun or ejected by gravitational interactions, and Tom is, of course, the expert on this process, into the outer solar system or into escape from the sun. And so you would have removed essentially all of those ancient primordial leftovers that NASA thinks they're still looking at. And the stuff we're now looking at is, in fact, the differentiated fragments that once were in a nice planet orbiting between Mars and Jupiter that for some reason one afternoon blew up, and we're seeing the rain back of the pristine, preserved, frozen parts, and the inner solar system is populated by the, as Tom said, baked-out fragments that still remain in close orbit in the asteroid belt.
How dramatic would this all be, Tom or Richard, if they come forward and say, our beliefs of how comets originated, what they were, thinking they were dirty snowballs, they're not. We were wrong. The new data shows us that they are this, that they could be like an asteroid or something else. Would that be dramatic, that kind of a statement?
It would be stunning.
They've come dangerously close to saying that, because actually on one of the Deep Impact websites, one of the official websites, there are implications of various findings, and one of those lists, if the surface of the comet turns out to have structural strength, as an asteroid would, solid rock, this would imply that comets are not primordial. It actually says that.
Wow.
Now, why do you say dangerously close? Why that phrase?
Because I'm sure that they'll back away from that when the data actually goes in that direction, because there's just been too much investment in the Whipple model of dirty snowballs. It's in all the textbooks. All the leading astronomers teach that model exclusively. The technical papers galore use that model. And when you have so much investment in terms of careers and money and experiments, they don't easily change their minds.
Okay, Tom Van Flandern, stay with us along with Richard C. Hoagland. We'll be back with their great minds in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I guess while I was on vacation, the History Channel ran a little interview they did with me reacting to the theories of the late Colonel Philip Corso the day after Roswell. And I guess it went very, very well. As a matter of fact, I've had a lot of emails from a lot of you about that. Richard C. Hoagland and our guest Tom Van Flandern will be back in a moment. Next hour, we will open up the phone lines. Richard C. Hoagland will be with us, along with physicist James McCanny. We'll take a few moments as well, get Richard's thoughts about the movie War of the Worlds when we come back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Richard C. Hoagland, Tom Van Flandern, our guests this hour. Richard, what would your reaction be overall to this mission? Successful? Confusing? How would you categorize it?
Oh, I think it's incredibly successful. And again, I want to echo what Jim McCanny said. You know, the scientists, the engineers, the flight directors, the program people, the managers have all done, in a relatively incredibly short time, a major, you know, technological feat here. And I want to put this in context. I mean, they were saying over and over again last night in all the commentaries how very hard this was. You know, the idea of basically, you know, sending a bullet to catch a bullet, being photographed by a bullet all simultaneously. And the only problem with that analogy is that bullets are passive. Once you fire them from the gun, that's it. These bullets had computers, optical trackers, and rockets on them, and their courses could be adjusted. You know, the impactor was really a smart bomb. Now, we don't think it carried explosives, although one of the curiosities could be that the huge jet of material that came out very surprisingly last mm-hmm. night was because they had some explosives in that thing as opposed to just the impact. I don't really believe that, but, you know, that's one of the things that NASA's activities over the last several decades of not telling us the total truth has raised the specter that, well, they're not exactly telling you the whole truth. Like when I watched them dance around the questions today about composition, I was not happy because, frankly, they should be very forthright and they should tell us, you know, I mean, they should have seen a huge amount of water if, as he said, this thing went down and struck the ice layer of what they think is a dirty snowball. The fact that the infrared spectrometers didn't record a humongous amount of water, like looking at old faithful, right there says there's something wrong. Now, this is not the first time this has happened. Remember all the hoopla, Tom, around Shoemaker-Levy 9 and
yes,
the impact into Jupiter?
Mm-hmm. Quite
and
true.
And then when they kind of got around to telling us the details, there was an incredible lack of water vapor in the fragments of Shoemaker-Levy 9, even after they slammed into the Jupiter atmosphere. And that kind of got covered up. That really is a glaring contradiction to the mainstream model. It's a glaring confirmation of Van Flandern's model, and NASA just doesn't want to talk about it.
What did you think of the video, Richard?
Oh, the video is absolutely astonishing. What I think is interesting, and I'm sure in the Q&A we're going to get into some of the Jim McCanny's ideas, I don't think the video supports Jim's idea, and I'll tell you why. This plume, this plasma plume that you see first, is characteristic of an object that penetrates deeply into the comet and then creates a superheated column of highly compressed gases that are basically as hot as the surface of the sun. They then blast out back up this tunnel that it's physically carved
mm-hmm.
in smashing into the thing, and it becomes, in effect, a kind of an interplanetary shotgun. So the first stuff that emerged from that hole was the plasma of the probe itself plus anything lining that tunnel all the way back up to the surface, and we don't know how deeply it penetrated. And that was that super bright, hot flare that you saw. And then, of course, there's a tremendous amount of dust released, you know, because of the vapor pressures and the, you know, the high winds and basically just the overpressure of high-temperature material. And then you had entrainment of a lot of other stuff that was encased in that hole. And then you had a surface cratering phenomenon, which Tom can talk to, you know, if he wants. But in fact, you didn't have a pre-impact spark, which is what the McCanny model would have predicted based on a charge differential between the comet and the deep impact spacecraft.
And see, what I have a hard time understanding, Richard and Tom, is, you know, the deep impact probe was about the size of a barrel. How could that create that kind of flash effect with the comet, unless maybe it had something else in that barrel that would have created it, something nuclear maybe?
It was totally vaporized by just the speed of impact. Sometimes we don't appreciate how very much speed is a factor in the amount of energy released. It said that a spacecraft that encounters a puff of cigarette smoke at typical interplanetary speeds would be damaged by that, just because even though the particles are very tiny, their velocities are so high, they're like little miniature bullets.
I mean, remember, George, this thing was moving at 6 miles per second.
Yes.
And it was about the size and weight of, a very heavy washing machine. It was about 800 pounds. And there was, like 150 pounds of copper, Tom, I think, that was designed to be the impactor. And the rest was spacecraft, electronics and plumbing and computers and stuff like that. But it's that incredible velocity, because remember, the energy that you release when you hit a hard surface, when you smash into your brick wall, goes up as the square of the velocity. Kinetic energy is mv squared. So you have to, you know, multiply by the square for every factor of two that you go up. And at 7 miles per second, that was enough to vaporize and create a plasma, to create an incandescent gas, probably as hot as the surface of the sun, 6,000-7,000 degrees, that blasted back up like a shotgun charge up through that tunnel that the actual impact had carved in slicing down through this material, whether it was fluffy dust on the surface, ice below it, or it's fluffy dust and rock, you know, and then all those other things happened in the next few, you know, milliseconds. And you can see in this time-lapse imagery, you know, this was like having one of those old high-speed Edgerton strobe photography videos or films we used to see back in high school, where you see the bullet shattering the glass or the hummingbird's wings frozen in mid-flight. I mean, we've got some astonishing close-up video, which, frankly, is going to tell them a lot of the surface properties if, in fact, they're honest with the data.
Well, now, what does this also do to the theory of life and how it started? Because does this then, if for some reason we don't have these comets as being the seeds of life, does this mean that those people, the spiritualists who believe in, you know, the very spiritual way that life has originated on this planet and maybe elsewhere in this universe, that they've got the upper hand here now? Who wants that?
Tom is being very quiet.
He is. And I've never heard you this quiet.
I'm trying to be polite, George.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay. Keep trying, Richard.
Comets do bring organic molecules to planets that they're impacting on all the time. So whether they are primordial or whether they are remnants of a planet that must have had the seeds of life on it. Either way, the comets could still be the conveyors of material and water to Earth, but just much more latter day and in a, from a much more evolved source than what we're used to thinking of. The alternative to the dirty snowball model is called the satellite model, and it indicates that a comet is a huge cloud of debris from the explosion of this parent planet, because every large chunk of or every nucleus will gravitationally capture a lot of dust and larger debris with it as it flies away from the exploding parent. And we've been through a round already of making model predictions and having the results come in. In 1991, I went to the world meeting of asteroid, comet, and meteor experts and gave a paper saying that the exploded planet hypothesis predicted that the first spacecraft visit to asteroids would find satellites around the asteroids. Astronomer Don Yeomans, who's a principal with the Deep Impact mission and a comet expert, was a chairman of the session, and he challenged me on the spot, and he said, "Tom, I'm going to bet you a case of fine California wine that the spacecraft will not find any satellites for any of the missions that visit asteroids." And I said, "Well, I'm predicting that one of the first three asteroids visited will produce at least one satellite." Well, in 1993, about 18 months later, I heard rumors dealing with the visit of one of the early probes to
Galileo.
Galileo to asteroid Ida. And I called up Don, and as soon as he heard my voice, he laughed, and he said, "I was just saying to some colleagues, it looks as though I'm going to be." We had altered the bet because I'm a teetotaler to a case of orange juice from wine, and he said, "It looks as though I'm going to be squeezing some orange juice for Tom Van Flandern," because the probe did find a satellite around that asteroid.
And the odds are stunning, George, against that happening unless most of them have satellites.
Right. Right, very. You know, the Europeans were watching this with great awe. They've got the Rosetta spacecraft that's supposed to rendezvous with a comet in 2014,
yep,
which is, you know, 9 years away.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's a long time. I mean, what's taking that one so long? We just launched ours, and it made it so fast. What's the big difference? Why'd they pick a comet that's so far away or whatever they're doing?
Well, the principal difference is that when you're just smashing a probe into a comet, you don't have to worry about the niceties of matching the comet's orbit and rendezvousing with it, which takes a lot more fuel and a lot more of getting the conditions just right. So it's that difference in velocity. In this case, the 6 miles a second worked to the advantage of the experiment, because you wanted to smash the probe into the comet and get a blast and see what was below the surface. For the Rosetta mission, they want a rendezvous with the comet, so they have to find one where they can match the velocity and track get into the comet's orbit and track along with it without having to carry a massive amount of fuel into space.
You know, one of the things that one of our colleagues, Ron Nix, who's a geologist, who's been on the program with both me and Art in previous years, said last night, or maybe it was tonight, we were talking about all this data. He said, "You know, what's amazing to me is that here you have a space agency that can't seem to keep meters and feet separate, and yet they pull off this incredible technical, you know, impossible feat and make it look easy. What's wrong with this picture?" And, of course, the answer is that NASA sometimes doesn't tell us the entire truth about the things it's doing or the excuses it puts out for the things that it apparently doesn't do sometimes.
Well, but why in this case do you think NASA might be holding back?
The data? Well,
yeah.
Think about it. If if Tom is right, you know, that means that planets blow up. Now, do you want to tell 6 billion people on Earth that the planet beneath their feet someday might blow up? It's for the same reason you guys were talking earlier, you know, do we think this was a test of the ability to rendezvous and, you know, knock comets away or deflect asteroids or whatever, and obviously that is what's going on here, and they didn't tell anybody that, right?
Well, do they blow up or do they collide then blow up?
Well, Tom for years has maintained that they blow up, and he hasn't really had a good physics to explain how a planet blows up. I believe we've got the physics to explain where that energy comes from, and it's a matter of just the details of melding the two ideas together. But the mainstream guys are loath to admit that the solar system has changed almost in any significant way in the last 4.5 billion years.
Well,
now,
is it an evolutionary thing, though, Richard and Tom, that a planet blows up, or is it just chance?
Evolutionary thing, I'd say clearly, and the direct evidence we have from asteroid and comet orbits is that the explosions are central, not surface, so impacts are not a possible mechanism for these, and nor is it very likely that civilizations are blowing them up, because what evidence we have suggests that these events are spaced by millions of years and
or hundreds of millions.
So, I mean, are you saying every planet, for example, in this solar system eventually will blow itself up?
I'd say that's very likely true for all planets, certainly in a normal range of masses. It's probably true of most classes of stars, too. These very large objects tend to end their life in a massive explosion, followed by a collapse to something like a white dwarf in the case of stars.
I mean, one stunning example is for the last, it's several hundred years, we've had observations going back to pre-telescopic astronomy and then with the invention of the telescope of things in the galaxy called nova. They were called nova in the Latin, which means new star, because, you know, a guy was looking up one night and he saw the normal constellations, and the next night he looks up and, oh my God, there's a new star. And for a while it was thought these were new stars, forming stars. As science got more sophisticated, we realized we were watching the death of something as opposed to the birth of something. And mainstream astronomy thinks that nova are basically ancient exploding stars that blow up because of instabilities on the surface of white dwarfs and stuff like that. Well, Tom's idea that you can have, you know, planetary systems where planets every once in a while go poof makes for an extraordinary alternative idea, George, that the nova that we see in the galaxy, which is typically on the order of, what, one every 5 or 6 years, is actually a planet like what used to orbit the sun blowing up in another star system. And if that's true, with the new technology being developed by NASA and the Europeans for finding planets around stars like Planet Finder and Kepler and whatever, we will actually be able to test that model on the next nova and maybe actually discern the fingerprints that would differentiate between a star blowing up or having a hiccup and a planet, you know, meeting its demise.
Well, I got to tell you, if you believe in extraterrestrial life, Richard, and you then believe in Tom's theory about planets blowing themselves up, one might conclude that these beings out there are pretty adept at knowing that their planet's close to the end, and they're looking for other places to go.
That's an exquisite idea, George. Doesn't that really provide an impetus for why there might be interstellar migrations and visitors and that whole thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what did, you know, I mean, what was the classic H.G. Wells novel all about? The Martians moving from Mars to Earth because they basically wanted to get off a planet that was dying? Well, it was dying peacefully in the novel. If Tom is right, planets don't die peacefully. And frankly, I think the data is overwhelming that Tom is right.
Tom, could Mars, though some say is a dying or dead planet, could it blow up at any time?
Well, not at any time, but sometime in the future. But the more intriguing idea is that Mars, there's good evidence for this, we probably don't have time to get into, that Mars is a former moon of the planet that blew up.
That's a great theory.
Oh, exquisite evidence.
Great
smashing
theory.
Evidence.
Hey, Tom, I want to thank you for being part of the program with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, George.
Tom Van Flander. He's a good guy, Richard, isn't he?
He sure is. Get some rest, Tom. You deserve it.
And Richard C. Hoagland will be around. James McCanney will be right back with us as well. We'll take phone calls. We're going to take a few minutes and talk about Richard's blog about War of the Worlds also when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. Fascinating night. And Richard C. Hoagland with us, James McCanney. Richard, before I bring in the professor and get to the phone calls where people are lining up already by the thousands, your blog on your enterprisemission.com website, I like it. I like what you're doing. I think, make it even more interesting than it was. And an interesting perspective on War of the Worlds.
It's going to give me some freedom that I really cherish to express more opinions without having to endlessly document and footnote.
It's like an editorial.
Exactly. It's an editorial or a column, and it allows me to be a little looser. I can use looser language. I can speak more, you know, like you and I speak when we're not on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can share things with people that I don't have to support because it's an opinion. And, you know, people can either yell at me or not, as the case may be. But, you know, it's just an opinion. And what I want to do is to use the format to get ideas out there that are completely being ignored, again, by the mainstream in the middle of the, you know, country, and that need to be discussed. And I'll give you one example. You know, in all honesty, I've got to tell you that Robin, separate from Ron, came up this afternoon with the same idea that, I mean, because she's been watching all this coverage for the last 24 hours, because I had it on endlessly, much to her chagrin sometimes. And finally she said to me, you know, how is it they can do this impossible thing, and they claim they're the game that can't shoot straight with Hubble and the Mars stuff and some of the other things. It's like she saw the contradictions from someone who was not an expert, who was not a specialist, who's just, you know, a very smart person who looked at this and said, wait a minute, what's wrong with this picture? When NASA wants to perform, they can do miracles. When they don't, they claim the dumbest, most stupid excuses, and people let them get away with it.
Like the conversion of the meters and the inches and the
feet? And the feet and all. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So my blog is going to be a platform where I can basically take to task the stupid political stuff that they're doing, and I'm also going to, you know, expound upon some other things. You know, I'm a citizen. You know, I voted for president. I, you know, have an interest in my community. And I'm going to look at other things that may require, you know, the Hoagland perspective. And people, again, can take it or leave it. It's just an opinion unless I document it and footnote it and give you the links, in which case you should take it a little more seriously.
And you got a pretty interesting perspective about War of the Worlds as well.
I am fascinated by the synchronicity. And this is where we're going to go with the blog in the next few days. The synchronicity between Steven Spielberg's new mega hit, War of the Worlds, and the Deep Impact mission. Now, you probably don't think there's a connection, right?
I don't think there's a connection.
I will lay out for your, what was it Rod Serling used to say, for your approval, potential connections in the next few days.
All right.
And you can take it or leave it. But it gives me that freedom. Now, to go back to War of the Worlds, I started out, you know, when you're doing one of these things, the first thing you think about is, oh, my God, what am I going to say? And as you know, I'm not shy a lot of the time.
I've never seen you for a loss of words.
Except when we had, what's her name, Miss Blaylock on, remember that night?
Oh, yes,
anyway,
Jolene from the Star Trek. Yep.
Yes, yes. So I normally have some opinions on some things, but when it came to doing this, I really had writer's block. I couldn't think of what to do.
Well, now, what happened? Because what I read was not writer's block.
Well, I'll tell you what happened is you went on vacation. And Hilly was doing a show one night. In the first hour, it was Wednesday night, when he talked about, you know, Cruise and Spielberg's new movie. And it was like, well, duh, you know, the guy everybody thinks of as the Mars guy probably should talk about this movie, where the Martians come and invade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that got me thinking in the direction of that area. And the more I looked into it, the more astonishing things I found. And as you know, the quintessential thing, which I really claim I have found beyond anybody else on the planet, so I put it in the blog. Remember James Banford, who was the author who does the NSA profiles.
Mm-hmm.
He's an exquisite investigator. He's done several 600-plus page books on the National Security Council and the intelligence agencies and the CIA and all that. He is the one who uncovered this bizarre operation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff back during the Kennedy years called Operation Northwoods. And you talked about it during your 911 roundtable
the
other night.
Absolutely. It's a startling.
It is shocking. It's startling. It is so demeaning to the Constitution, to the America that we all believe, particularly to tonight, which is the anniversary of the birth of this extraordinary experiment, America. Anyway, it is without question that Operation Northwoods was an official proposal by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the people running the Pentagon, who are supposed to serve at the pleasure of the president and the Constitution and the American people, and it recommended a laundry list of incredible, illegal, and stupid and manipulative things to basically blame the Cubans when it was going to be us that was going to shoot people, shoot down airplanes, sink ships, and even potentially sabotage John Glenn's
mm-hmm.
first flight into orbit.
Yep.
Okay, Operation Northwoods. Burn that into your brain. So I'm doing the research on Orson Welles and War of the Worlds and all that, and I'm interested because, remember, he did this for CBS, CBS Radio.
Yeah.
CBS is my old alma mater, so I have a more than passing interest in CBS stuff.
October 31st, 1938?
Actually, the 30th. The 31st was Halloween. It was the night before Halloween. It was a Sunday night.
All right.
But, you know, what's 24 hours among friends? What do you think was my reaction when I found... Again, the web is an incredible research tool. Someone who is also as much in love with that whole War of the Worlds radio phenomenon as I was, and interested in its reasons, its psychology, background. This person, her name is Elizabeth, I forget her last name, maybe it's McLeod. She found that at 425 Madison Avenue, which is where the old CBS War of the Worlds Studio One was mm-hmm. located, on the 20th floor, it no longer exists. CBS just was renting the building back in the 30s. It's now got other tenants. It's got boutiques. It's got shops, whatever. It's even got a radio station, but it's on the third floor, and it's owned by the Spanish. It has nothing to do with CBS. But on the 20th floor, in the original studio that Orson Welles did the show, which panicked America that night, there is a venture capital firm named Northwoods.
Oh.
Now, what the hell is that supposed to mean? When I was researching another article, which is our IAPITA series, and I worked on the work of Francis Crick, the Nobel laureate mm-hmm. who found DNA, I found some papers by him where he tries to calculate the numerical odds of DNA forming by accident, you know, from primordial molecules, organic molecules. And the analogies he uses is the X number of chimpanzees using X number of typewriters for X number
right.
of years to type a particular word. If you're looking for randomness, the idea that you would have an Operation Northwoods and then Northwoods Ventures in the Orson Welles studio that manipulated America into thinking we were being invaded by Martians, the first PSYOPs program, if we're right, and it wasn't an accident, it was deliberate, if we're right, and they would have the same name, the two organizations attached to the same studio. The odds are literally, George, trillions to one that that can be an accident.
Not going to say you're wrong about that part.
Remember your first rule. There are no coincidences.
That is true. Hey, let's bring in the professor. I want people to go to theenterprisemission.com, read Richard's blog, and he'll have more about that a little bit later on. And we will get to your calls as well, but we'll bring in Professor McCanny as well. Jim, you might have been vindicated on this mission, huh?
Well, I'll tell you something. It's looking not too good for the home team, as Richard was saying earlier. And by the way, hello, Richard. I don't know, with all of the time on Coast to Coast we both have spent, we've been on the same night together.
We have never been on the same night. We have friends that are begging us to be on together. And I was honored when, in their infinite wisdom, George and his staff decided to do this. You and I do need a night to kind of talk about some really cool things. We're not going to have time tonight, but I want to say very clearly for the record that I am not opposed to Professor McCanny's idea. because regardless of the origin of comets or things like that, because of the way the solar system works, they will become electrical. And there will be all kinds of interesting plasma and electrical interactions. And so it is by no means beyond high probability that some facets of Jim's model could also be confirmed in this deep impact experiment.
Well, what you share, though, along with Van Flandern, is the fact that McCanny feels, Jim feels, that the comets are not dirty snowballs.
Right. And I was going to say that in science, as in set theory, you have groups and ideas, and rarely do you get two scientists that agree on everything, but there's clearly overlapping agreement between Van Flandern's ideas and mine in that these are rocky objects. They clearly formed under extreme pressure and under the environment, either in the center of a star or a planetary object, and now they are chunks and pieces of this floating around. And let's take one example. Say this explosion occurred, whether it was internal or by collision, and one of these chunks is ejected from our solar system and it flies for eons and eons, and it lands and is captured in another solar system. Turn that around. Could some of these objects that we see now in ours have come from someplace else? Some of them are from here. It's a collage. It's a mixture, and we're just starting to scratch the surface. So we have a long way to go, but clearly I would say there's some overlap of ideas. How much is hard to say at this time with Van Flandern's work and mine. And time will tell, experiments will tell, and I know Tom Van Flandern is aware, as I am, that you have to define experiments to prove your concepts, and I've done that. I've done that from the very beginning.
Yeah, and you need to make some very specific predictions, and some of the predictions that we didn't get into vis-a-vis Tom and my discussion was what we expect in the next few days. If the NASA guys are going to be honest, they will report that does not, you know, comport with their, you know, pristine primordial Berge bits ideas.
Right, exactly. So, and there again, Richard, you and I on certain topics may agree or not agree, and sometimes we'd agree on the same thing for different reasons.
Well, just as an aside, let me tell you, I really love your hurricane ideas.
Oh, thank you.
I really think there's an extraordinary amount of evidence that they're certainly not thermal engines, as the Weather Service keeps trying to tell us. And if you go and look at our hyperdimensional hurricane ideas, you'll see some real crossover with some of the things that you were talking about.
There again, that crossover. And I just came back from New Orleans, the American Geophysical Union meeting. They have just now, for the first time, tracked ionospheric electron density movement on top of a hurricane.
Isn't just that special?
The coincidence of the two
movements. There are no coincidences. All right, let's go to some phones. People are lining up. First-time caller line, where are you calling from? And you can direct your question to either Jim McCanny, Richard Hoagland, or both. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Stacy, and I'm calling from Westlake Village, Southern California. And by the way, I'm honored to be on here with you folks. And my question is for, as I said, whoever can answer it. Yesterday when I was, it was 10:53 p.m., I was looking up at Spica, and to the right of Spica, I saw a flash. And then I put my binoculars, because I'm just bare-eyed, and then I put my binoculars up, and I saw a dark streak go from Spica over toward Jupiter, and it ended up kind of like above Jupiter, and then I don't know what happened to it. Like, could I have actually seen the comet flash with my naked eye and then seen something ejected, or what do you think that was, or is it anything?
Well, for one thing, the comet was, if it was, you're in Southern California, so at the right time, it would have been low in the southwestern sky, and the comet was about, I think, two moon whips to the upper left of Spike. It was in about the 11 o'clock position.
And
so it wasn't south or down below or whatever, so that was probably an airplane landing at LAX with a strobe.
I don't think it was LAX, but... it was so, okay, I didn't think it could travel that fast towards Jupiter.
No.
So I got the wrong position. All right, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, International Line, where are you calling from? Hi there. Hello?
It's you.
Hello? Something's going on at that home.
Oh, interesting.
let's listen in on what they're saying.
America's listening.
Yes.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay, there you are. I was listening to you. Something was going on at your home. I heard people running around and talking.
Yeah, if they were saying the phone. I was wondering if I could ask Richard a few questions about his blog.
Sure.
Well, we just won because Jim's with us and we got a lot of calls to go through.
Okay. Well, I was wondering when you exactly started it, at night or last night or a couple of days ago?
No, it was two or three days ago. It was before we went to see, Robin and I went on, I think it was Saturday, to see War of the Worlds. And I wanted to put it down before I saw the movie, so I had it, like Tom would say, a priori predictions. And what's interesting is some of the things I predicted are in the film, and I'm going to do some follow-up once enough people have seen the film so I won't spoil the movie for them. And there's a kind of a judgment curve there when enough time goes by. I'm astonished, frankly, George, at how many of these reviewers just give it all away.
Quickly, too.
Yeah, it's astonishing. And so if you want a good movie, don't read the reviews. Go see the movie, you know, blow $20, who cares, and then read the reviews. But to read reviews before you go to a movie really is kind of, I don't
well,
get
it's,
that.
Well, it's, you know, the cart before the horse.
Exactly.
And it's not the way to. Hey, Jim, we'll take more calls when we come back. We've only got a few more moments here before the break. Are you happy that it appears that what they have found is not a comet that is just loaded with frozen ice and water?
Well, in the 1979 to 81, when I was working in Cornell, there was sufficient data then to show that that was not the case. This is just, for me, it's like I expected it all along. It's possibly a surprise for other people. But
Jim, doesn't that frost you, pun intended? I mean, everybody is looking at this process, and they're tiptoeing around like we shouldn't, you know, call a spade a spade. These folks are not being honest scientifically with our money.
Well, and I appreciate your candor on this topic because sometimes I feel like the Lone Ranger out here, you know, on that topic, and people don't quite understand the importance of this. I mean, we're dealing with science here. Let's get the science out. It's science. It's we have too many personalities and other issues going on.
Well, what I found so amazing is that they've all got bets on how big the crater is.
Yeah.
Now, and there's money, George. They're actually betting money on when they get these images down and they can do the image processing and see through that cloud of dust that came out what size the crater is. Now, wait a minute. You mean to tell me you've got a dog in that fight, you've got a money bet on how big the crater is. Doesn't that kind of affect your judgment as to how you're measuring things?
Well, I don't know. It's pretty remarkable that they were able to even do what they did. I just I think when they get the data, they're going to tell us the truth.
But if they only can interpret it because they have the special processing and we don't, we have to take their word, don't we?
Yes, of course we do.
One of the key predictions for the Van Flandern model is that the hole will be relatively small. The reason is because you're dealing with a rocky object, and you know when that stuff came blasting back up, the rock has a pretty good tensile strength. It's stern stuff, and so the bore would maintain its integrity.
I'll tell you what, though, pretty big flash for what could be a small crater.
You know, I want to interject something here. I believe in the break while I was off the air, I watched the video. It's called Impactor No More.
Yep.
I see a secondary flash.
There are two of them. You're right.
Right before it occurs, there's a beam that comes in from the sunward side.
Now, what does that mean?
I believe that's an electron beam that's attaching from the sunward side to the cloud. And I wonder if there was actually a nuclear explosion there.
Well, we talked a little bit about that. We'll talk about that more when we come back, and we'll take your calls. Quick night. I'm George Norrie, back with Richard C. Hoagland and James McKenney in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Jim, we talked about it tonight. You brought it up. I'll get your reaction. You too, Richard, as well. Do you think a nuke was used on that comet, Jim?
No, actually, I think it was a secondary effect of the cloud protruding from the nucleus and an electrical discharge coming in from the sunward side. It's very clear on the images. We were on break, I went to the video that was on my Explorer player, and I clicked 78 times into the video, 78 frames, and you'll see at that point the secondary explosion, and then you see the electron beam coming clearly from the sunward side. I think that was an electron component in the overall electron beam that comes from the sunward side, the same thing that causes X-rays to the sunward side of comets, and attached to that protruding explosion of dust and material and actually ignited it. So that's my current, current thought.
Richard, yeah. Someone writes, by the way, and says that the impact was the equivalent of 63,600 1957 Cadillacs strapped together hitting the surface.
At what speed?
At hitting the surface at 88 feet per second or 60 miles an hour.
Actually, we're told it was about 5 tons of dynamite or TNT equivalent. Now, look, here's where the science gets really cool, because if Jim is right, when they give us the temperature of that cloud that's ejected from what I call the borehole, it'll have a certain kinetic temperature that the spectra will measure. If it was electrical, it'll have one temperature. If it was the plasma from the impact, it will have another temperature. If it was a nuclear weapon, it will have a much higher temperature. Plus, there will be other effects. There'll be X-rays, very high pulse of X-rays, et cetera, et cetera. If we get the data, all of these various ideas that seem to most people, I'm sure tonight, wildly speculative, can be tested, and that's what science is. We've gotten away from the idea that no matter how far out your theory, if you can look at the data and make predictions and test it, it isn't really far out. It's what science does. And yet we've politicized science so that certain ideas are permissible to discuss, and if Ahern and the guys were listening to the show tonight, and actually, they may be at JPL because you know that you're one of their favorite radio programs, George. You know that, right?
I know that, but I also know they'd like to listen to you.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, they would be shocked, pun intended, Jim, to hear us discussing in public, you know, not behind closed doors, some of these outrageous ideas. But the idea is you can test all of them, and once you get the data and can eliminate the ones that don't work, you go with the ones that do. It's called science, boys and girls. Why be afraid of the process?
You sound like Mr. Wizard now,
well,
Richard.
Well, I heard the show you did with it.
To the phones we go. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Leonard from Gadsden, Alabama. Yeah, do you think, question is to either one of you two gentlemen,
right,
or even you, George. You think when NASA's asked to explain things and we get unclear response, it's because, do you think it's because there's so many divisions in NASA, from rocket scientists to astronauts to administration, and by the time the response gets around to the spokesperson for NASA, they really don't know what to say?
This one's for you, Richard.
Well, you're not dealing with spokespersons. For instance, you're looking at the Deep Impact press conferences at the principal investigator and his team, Michael Ahern from the University of Maryland, where, by the way, Tom Van Flanderen has taught extensively, so he knows Michael. So we have a better-than-even shot that over a beer, although Tom doesn't drink, we'll find out some stuff that we may not find out in public, given enough time. But the main problem, I think, is that these guys are politically constrained by what the conventional wisdom is, and they know if they go out too much on a limb and violate the common perception, the next time they apply for a NASA grant, it's going to be, the next guy's going to get it. You didn't follow the rule, even if they're unspoken.
Good point. Wildcard line, your turn. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Brittany from Midland.
Hi, Brittany.
Hi. I just had a question for Richard, and that was, sorry, it's my daughter.
That's okay. How old is she?
She's about to be a month and a half.
Future coast-to-coast listener. Excellent.
Wow, that's early.
Okay. Well, anyway, Richard, I was just wondering if it was dangerous to shoot a comet if it was close to the Earth.
Well, as I think Jim mentioned earlier, the main problem with using this technique to deflect things getting close is that if you fragment them, then you're hit by a whole bunch of pieces as opposed to one chunk.
If we had shot it and it had like a whole bunch of pieces, wouldn't that be better than one chunk?
It depends on how big the pieces are and where they hit. because, as you know, with a shotgun, you know, that's why people go out and shoot birds with shotgun pellets, because the odds are that you'll get it as opposed to, you
right.
know, a single bullet.
Right.
If you break it into chunks and one chunk falls on Paris and the other on L.A. and one, it, well, we've all seen that movie, right? So you don't want, what you want to do is deflect it. And if Jim is right about the electrical nature of the solar system, which I think he is, we can disagree with details, but I think the main thing is there's some amazing electrical stuff going on out there that's not being acknowledged, then the elegant way to, using just normal physics, not the hyperdimensional things that I talk about, but just normal physics, would be to use the charges of these things to deflect them, which are so much more powerful than gravity, you know, like, what is it, 10 to the 40th times or something, Jim?
Well, it's the tail drag. You drag in this tail of material, and as it attaches electrically to the comet, it slows it down.
It would change the mass, change the inertia, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, so there's some really cool things that we should be pursuing in the way of Jim's physics, and all of it gets swept under the rug because the mainstream guys own the cards. They own the card table. They own the building in which the card game is being played, and they own the TV network over which the card game is being aired.
But regardless, this was a tremendous campaign, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, regardless of that, truth is getting out. The Internet is stunningly important. Programs like this program, George, are priceless. I mean, I was really pleased that you wanted to put Tom on because Tom deserved to have a national platform tonight to discuss his exquisitely presented, peer-reviewed scientific model, and he's frozen out, pun intended, of the NASA game because they just don't like his model.
And I don't know why not. The guy's got credentials that go a mile long.
Because he's talking about planets blowing up, George. It would not be good for the stock market.
Well, I guess not. But we're not going to blow up tomorrow, are we?
No.
Good. First time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there. Hello?
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Hello?
Go ahead.
We are here.
Hi, this is Scott in Austin. And I was just curious as to if either of the gentlemen believed in the Orpheus theory, which was, you know, the fourth planet between Earth and Mars, possibly creating the moon by some massive collision, you know, several billion years back. And if could that collision have sent the comet material or asteroid material into space or into our orbit? I mean, are these comets coming from the beginning of the universe, or are they maybe from a collision at some point?
Well, they're coming from primarily within our solar system, remnants of what was formed. Jim McCanny, you don't believe they're coming in from outside, do you?
Oh, yes. I think it's a mixture. I absolutely think it's a mixture. And I gave the example earlier. Say this planet exploded here in our solar system. Some of those objects would be thrown out of our solar system.
Sure.
And they would keep going, and someday some of them
might come back,
end up in another star system being captured, and vice versa.
Right.
If
okay.
you reverse that, you know, some of what we're seeing. So we're dealing with a collage here that I think it's going to take a long time for us to sort out what came from where.
Now, scientists are also theorizing, of course, that the moon was formed from the remnants of either this planet that smashed into Earth, or came from Earth itself, but they say that we got hit twice by this object. Do you agree with this?
Well, there again, this is speculation. It's very difficult to imagine how a particular object came to be in the past because we haven't seen them. I believe that, here's an example, the moon could have been in its orbit here first and the Earth came later. I mean, there's possibilities when you look at the possibility of capture.
All right, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, it's Robert calling from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah, hello, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, I got a question for Richard.
Yep.
Richard, you mentioned two different velocities of this spacecraft traveling towards the comet. One was 23,000 kilometers an hour. And
no, 23,000 miles per hour.
Yep. Oh.
Not kilometers, miles.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. I thought it was kilometers because I got on the calculator and I thought, holy smokes. Between 6 miles a second and 23,000 kilometers.
No, 23,000 miles per hour. For some reason, you know, NASA normally puts out their data in kilometers. They put it out in the English system this time as miles per hour. Now, think about the political implications of that.
Come on, Richard. You're reading into everything.
Well, no, actually, I'm going to be writing a book pretty soon. It'll probably be out next year, and you'll find that the measurements are very important.
Well, I know that, the fact that they put it out in miles instead of kilometers, what does that mean?
What it means is that maybe they're alluding to probably what I'm going to be writing about is that there's three different measurement systems that are very dependent on each other to understand this physical reality that we're in. And you'll read about it probably within about a year. And they're all integrated.
You think he's onto something?
You can't work one without the other.
You think he's onto something here, Richard?
I totally concur.
All right, maybe I jumped on you too soon then.
You can do that.
Wild Card Line, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Good morning. This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John.
Morning.
Morning. I wonder what both or either one of you might think about the uranium core of planets, including our own theory, and also how that might relate to Van Flandern's theories and planets blowing up.
Who wants that?
I'll start with that one.
All right.
Clearly, it has always been a difficulty trying to identify where the elements that we find on Earth come from, not the least of which is water, salt in the oceans, a lot of the minerals, the heavy elements, where did they come from? They must have come from a stellar fusion process. That's our current understanding. So I believe that this experiment today and the conclusion that these are probably not dirty snowballs brings up a whole new laundry list of questions, and that is just one of them.
It sure should.
The origin of planets, the origin of the elements in the planet, very many questions that are on the table right now.
Well, Jim, you're a plasma guy. I presume you've read Hannes Alfvén's classic book.
Oh, absolutely. I've read probably everything on the planet.
Who was basically the grandfather of modern plasma theory.
Right.
And a distant countryman of mine. You know, he was a Swede, too. Anyway, Alfvén has some exquisite chapters in this book about the modeling of the creation of the solar system, George. And it's completely different, radically, 180 degrees different than any of the conventional models. And it has to do with the electrical nature of atoms and how atoms get together and build little things and bigger things and finally planets, and how atoms will segregate depending upon where they are in distance from the sun. You'll have the heavy elements close and the light elements far away and all this. And it's again, completely ignored, and he won a Nobel Prize for his plasma physics work.
Unlike Velikovsky, who they just chased away.
Yeah, because he was not a physicist or a scientist. He was a psychologist.
That's true.
The clubbishness is overwhelming.
Next up, Wild Card Line, your turn. You're on. Hi.
Yes, hi. This is Linda in Sacramento.
Hi, Linda.
I had a couple of questions on the safety. One is the question of bringing back bits of stuff to Earth that may have pathogenic viruses that we're not used to dealing with.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. The
Me
whole Stardust
too.
Mission.
Thank you.
And just so you don't forget, the other one will be, if there was a nuclear explosion with that second flash, would anybody of your panel have any idea whether that magnitude and the distance that it occurred would be adding to more of our nuclear problems here?
83 million miles away, I would say probably not.
Okay.
But you, Richard, why don't you first take the question on the possibility of viruses and things like that. They may
well,
have tests.
Again, if Tom is right, if these are really pieces of a former planet, an Earth-like planet that used to orbit between Mars and Jupiter, where Mars was a satellite of it, and it had life on it, then what we're doing, we're dealing with bits and pieces of a planet with former life forms. You go and you scoop them up, and you bring them back, and you land them in Utah, and the container cracks open like the Genesis mission did a few months ago, You wind up with all these little microbes scurrying across the Utah desert and gleefully jumping into the nearest lake or pool. Not a good idea, which is why I'm very concerned with the Stardust mission, because NASA, in their mainstream model, cannot imagine that there could be life in these things or on these things, and we could be preparing for the world's biggest back contamination problem unless we take the appropriate precautions. And I frankly don't know whether they even have thought of this,
sounds
let
like
alone done anything.
Martian Chronicles all over again?
All over again, yes.
Go ahead, Jim.
It's absolutely correct. Let's start right here. I've announced this on other forums that I've been on, and we have to have a moratorium on bringing stuff back from outer space.
Until we get the right model and the right containment procedures, and the best way to do it would be not to bring it back to Earth at all, but we've got a damn space station. That's what the
absolutely
space station should be used for.
Absolutely. It's got to be handled out there. It's good to study this stuff, but don't bring it down here, please.
Let's see if we have time for one more quick call. East of the Rockies. Hi there.
Yes, hi. Good morning. How are you, gentlemen?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
This is Keith in Brooklyn. More than a pleasure. Long-time listener. I have a question. If there was something hurtling to us from outer space, instead of actually firing something at it, would it be possible to fire an inert object near it, disrupting its trajectory by causing a wake?
Jim, you talked a little bit about deflecting objects. What do you think?
Well, you'd have to send something very large because gravitational fields are very weak. And that's why, with this particular comet nucleus, its gravitational field, I would have not calculated it, but would be very small. If you were standing on it, just the slightest motion would send you off into outer space away from it. So you would have to send something, you know, the size of our moon to deflect it. But there are other ways to do that. As I was talking about earlier, creating electric fields or extending the current electric field, bringing in more material, changing its orbit. So there are some creative ways to deal with that, hopefully, and we'll learn about those and be able to use them.
We're running out of time. Jim McCanny's website is jmccannyscience.com. No need to worry about spelling it now. Just go to coasttocoastam.com, and there's a direct link to his website. Richard C. Hoagland, of course, enterprisemission.com, where he is now doing his own blogs, and they're pretty good, as a matter of fact.
And the Deep Impact blog will go up tonight.
Very good. Richard, thank you, and Jim, thank you as well.
Thank you, George.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. Good to be back from vacation. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.